From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM, and get ready for this Coast to Coast ride. But here's what's happening now. The Federal Trade Commission will try to regulate blogging for the very first time, requiring writers on the web to clearly disclose any freebies or payments that they get from companies for reviewing their products. The FTC said its commissioners voted 4-0 to approve the final web guidelines, which have been expected. Violating the rules, which take effect December 1st, could bring fines up to $11,000 per violation. Bloggers or advertisers also could face injunctions and be ordered to reimburse consumers for financial losses stemming from inappropriate product reviews. The commission stopped short of specifying how bloggers must disclose conflicts of interest. Rich Cleland, the assistant director at the FTC's Advertising Practices Division, said the disclosure must be clear no matter what form it will take. The bloggers have long praised or panned products and services online, but what some consumers might not know is that many of those companies pay reviewers for their write-ups or give them free products such as toys or computers or trips to Disneyland. In contrast, at traditional journalism outlets, products borrowed for reviews generally have to be returned. And in some cases, for example, you might have people comment on other websites as well. I'm not sure if that fits into this law or not, but they will make phony claims acting as if they're consumers. Very dangerous situation. A new government report finds that fewer U.S. high schools and middle schools are selling candy and salty snacks to students. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said its report was based on a survey of public schools in 34 states comparing results from 2006 to 2008. The share of schools that sell soda and artificial fruit drinks dropped from 62% to 37%. The report marked the continued effort by health officials to combat childhood obesity. And yesterday, we had a report out of the United Kingdom that said that children who are given a lot of sugar when they're smaller generally grow up to be mean and aggressive. Dr. Betty Martini spent 22 years in the medical field, founder of the Mission Possible International, an organization that educates the public on the dangers of aspartame. Betty, now this has got to be good, though, that schools are starting to cut back on sugar, huh?
Well, George, there's efforts everywhere. I don't know if you remember, but that Congress passed a bill giving the FDA the regulation over soda pop. And this was back in June, and then the FDA put out a note saying soda vending machines will be banned in all schools, hospitals, and public buildings, and children under 18 will be prohibited from purchasing soft drinks unless accompanied by an adult. Now, I'm waiting for that to happen. But there have been efforts, for instance, in British Columbia, even though the government said, aspartame is safe, the mothers got involved and said that they wanted them out of all the schools, any drinks with artificial sweeteners, and the mothers won. And then in Toronto, there was an effort, and they said that the sodas, schools set to can pop. Well, then at the very last minute, they said, well, we'll let it go another year. But it's happening really everywhere, and we're part of that effort because if on the website, mpwhi.com, if you scroll down, you'll see our report to schools where all the experts, Dr. Roberts, Dr. Blaylock, Dr. Walton, all wrote articles on how aspartame destroys the brains of our children and how it causes obesity. They think it's mostly, the sugar. But as you know, aspartame makes you crave carbohydrates so that you gain weight. And we've been sending that out every year, especially on Aspartame Awareness Weekend. And, for instance, the Chicago middle school and their grammar school, because of that report, removed diet drinks.
Well, the bottom line, as you know, Betty, parents, minimize the sugar intake of your children. Dr. Betty Martini's website, as she mentioned, mpwhi.com. It'll be linked up with our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. All the news guests that come on this program, the news guests who come in quickly and give major comments of the day's events, their websites will be on our Twitter feed. Betty, thank you. A Southern Illinois hospital where a woman was fatally burned during a surgical flash fire says it has adopted new safety procedures. Heartland Regional Medical Center in Marion says it has a new comprehensive plan to prevent such fires. The 65-year-old Janice McCall died on September 8th at a Tennessee hospital, 6 days after being burned on the operating table at the Heartland Hospital. It's a really sad situation there. An Illinois woman who set out on a treasure hunt for buried gold coins after finding a cryptic note in an antique rocking chair may have been the victim of a prolific prankster who died more than 30 years ago with the help of a donated backhoe now. Patty Hinken recently tore up a vacant lot in Springfield, Illinois, where a typewritten note signed by Chauncey Woolcott, found in an old chair she bought at auction last November, suggested that she would find a chest containing more than $250 in U.S. gold coins. The dig turned up nothing but bricks and old bottles. Hinken planned to return on Tuesday with the donated services of a man with ground-penetrating radar meant to detect any buried items, but the treasure's note promise may already be debunked. In the most profound financial change in recent Middle East history, Gulf Arabs are planning, along with China, Russia, Japan, and France, to end dollar dealings for oil, moving instead to a basket of currencies, including the Japanese yen and Chinese currency, the euro, gold, and a new unified currency planned for nations in the Gulf Cooperation Council, including our friends Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi, Kuwait, and Qatar. Secret meetings have already been held by finance ministers and central bank governors in Russia, China, Japan, and Brazil to work on this scheme, which will mean that oil will no longer be priced in dollars if this goes through. The plans, confirmed to the newspaper The Independent in the United Kingdom by both Gulf Arabs and Chinese banking sources in Hong Kong, may help to explain the sudden rise in gold prices, but it also augurs an extraordinary transition from dollar markets within 9 years. Jerry Corsi, of course, has written a number of books, including Black Gold Stranglehold. Jerry, is this a true story? When I was reading it, I'm saying, okay, this could be one of these urban legends on the internet, but it's real, isn't it?
It's a real story, George. I reported it in WorldNet Daily in my Red Alert newsletter last month. And Coast to Coast has been way ahead of the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times in London, in reporting on the demise of the dollar. It's a major subject of my new book, which will be out next month, America for Sale. The dollar is on its way out in international trade because China, which holds now $2 trillion in foreign exchange reserves, the most any country has ever held, and 80% of those holdings are in dollar assets. China does not want to take the risk of a devaluing dollar, so China is looking for alternatives, including working with the Gulf states to create a Gulf state Arab currency in which to deal with oil, or to use the International Monetary Fund special drawing rights as an alternative to the dollar for foreign exchange reserves and settling international trade.
Jerry, this
means the dollar's on the way out, George.
I was going to say this sounds like a push for not the Amero anymore. They've probably jumped way past that. I think we're going to a world economy, aren't we?
Well, very quickly. And the G20 meeting is talking about using the International Monetary Fund special drawing rights first in international trade as an international currency. We may still have regional currencies like the Amero, but you know, the whole issue that we've been talking about for years, George, you and I and Coast to Coast has been reporting this, WorldNet Daily, is that the dollar is no longer going to be the strong currency it's been since the end of World War II. And I think we will see pushes towards regional currencies, possibly the Amero. Maybe the world bankers will just leapfrog past the Amero. But the title of my new book, America for Sale, next month, I mean, I think we're dealing with the New World Order, which is right at the doorstep.
Well, you schedule yourself a full show with Lisa and Tom when you're ready to roll on that, all right?
You've got a deal. I'd be honored to be on the show with America for Sale next month.
All right, it's Jerome Corsi. It's happening. We've been talking about it for years. People laugh. Nah, not going to happen. It's happening. What about our friends? Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi, Kuwait, countries that we've defended. You know, we went into Kuwait. That was the first Gulf War. They're all selling us right down the drain. A Pennsylvania man who refuses to allow city officials to enter his home without a warrant has been forced out to stay in a hotel instead. Evicted by a notice posted on his door that forbids him from using or occupying the building he owns. Borough Ordinance 1188 of Langsdown, Pennsylvania, requires all rental properties, including the private residence of the landlord, if he lives on site, be subjected to annual inspections with or without a warrant. How about that? An American woman has been mauled to death by her pet black bear as she cleaned its cage. Pennsylvania police are saying that the 37-year-old woman, Kellyanne Walsh, was killed by the 350-pound bear. The victim had been keeping the animal inside a 15-by-15-foot steel cage near her house in Ross Township. She had tossed in some dog food to one side of the enclosure to distract the bear while she cleaned the other side, and it attacked her. And in Lakeland, Florida, a woman is recovering from serious injuries in the hospital after sheriff's investigators say that she was attacked by five raccoons. The 74-year-old woman was trying to shoo the animals away from her front door when they suddenly attacked her. Raccoons are known to be aggressive when going after food, but the sheriff out there says this attack was very unusual. Martine Collette discovered that she had the ability to diagnose and help heal injured and sick animals. She's heading up the Wildlife Way Station and currently the director of animal services there. Martine, I've got to ask you, what's going on with these animal stories? They seem to be so prevalent these days, attacking humans. Is there something weird going on here, or is this just happening?
I don't think there's anything weird going on. I think the case of the raccoons, for example, it was a female raccoon. She had some young baby raccoons with her. She probably felt threatened by the lady. The lady at 74 years of age may not have gone out there prepared to deal with an irate mother raccoon. And of course, when the mother attacked, the youngsters would there be there assisting her. So I don't think there's anything going on. It's just a tragic situation where the lady was not prepared to shoo them out properly.
And of course, with the black bear, I mean, you know what? I don't care if you raise this from a cub, you don't go into the cage like that, do you?
Well, you know, we have a saying at the Wildlife Way Station, that is a bear and you're not. There is an inequality in strength. And when you're dealing with animals such as bears or lions or tigers, there are protocols you must follow. And it is always a dangerous situation, regardless whether you're following protocols or not. But not knowing the full circumstances, it's not an unusual situation where an animal like that could hurt or kill a human being.
Martine, why do people keep these animals?
Well,
they should be in zoos or in places like the Wildlife Way Station.
You know, people think that they're different or they love this animal. And a lot of people mistake love for possession. You know, if you love it, you must have it for yourself.
You gotta have it. Yeah.
So it's one of those things. Very sad, very tragic.
You've got an event coming up on November 10th called Run for the Wild.
We do. It's our annual event. We're looking forward to it. And we're anticipating we will have some celebrities and a wonderful, wonderful turnout in a great California winery.
All right. Well, there's information on your website, which is wildlifewaystation.org. She does a great job for injured animals. An Italian scientist says he has reproduced the Shroud of Turin, a feat that he says proves definitively that the linen that some Christians believe as Jesus Christ's burial cloth is a medieval fake. The shroud, measuring 14 feet 4 inches by 3 feet 7 inches, bears the image reversed like a photographic negative of a crucified man that some believers say is Christ. Well, we have shown, they say, that this is possible to reproduce something which has the same characteristics as the shroud. The shroud, showing the back and front of a bearded man with long hair, his arms crossed on his chest, while the entire cloth is marked by what appears to be rivulets of blood from wounds in the wrists, feet inside. This is going to be a very controversial thing, let me tell you, because many people believe and will always believe that the Shroud of Turin is authentic. Now, the scientists involved in this say that they reproduce the full-size shroud using materials and techniques that were available in the Middle Ages. Up next, we're going ghost hunting. As a matter of fact, we're going to some of the most haunted places with Jeff Belanger next on Coast to Coast AM. And one of my favorite guests here on Coast to Coast, Jeff Belanger, leads a very haunted life. He's been fascinated with the supernatural since 10. Over the years, Jeff has interviewed hundreds of people about their experiences with an approach to the subject that truly makes the supernatural accessible to a huge audience. And Jeff is one of the most sought-after experts in the field, and we've got him tonight on Coast to Coast. Jeff, welcome back.
Hey, George, it's great to be back with you.
My pleasure. This is a great time. I love the fall, and I love as we get close to Halloween, don't you?
Oh, man, do I ever. And it must be October. We're talking again, and it's such a great time of year, especially I live here in New England, and the weather gets crisp, the leaves start to change, and it just feels right to talk about this, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm out here in St. Louis, and I could have sworn last week we were moving straight into wintertime, Jeff.
Yeah. No, and there's something about that change of season, and it makes you think about what's next. And it's been that way for so long. I think it all, you know, there's a seasonality to these stories and legends. There's something to it. It stirs us deep inside, and here we are talking about it.
You created ghostvillage.com. Tell me about that, and how did that all come about?
Well, it was a dark and stormy night like this one. 10 years ago now. Isn't that amazing?
It makes us
a grandpa on internet terms, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, the whole idea was to just put up a couple articles I had written on the paranormal when I was working for some newspapers back in the 90s. And I just put up something on the homepage that said, hey, tell us about your own ghost experiences. And boy, 10 years later, you know, 35,000 pages of content and people from all over the world sharing their personal experiences. And I've really come to realize through the website and through all the other avenues of research that it led to, just how big this subject is. I used to think it was very simple, you know, ghost haunted places, but boy, it's not. There's so many other aspects to this. There's religion, there's spirituality, there's belief, there's folklore, there's psychology, there's other avenues of the paranormal. It's not just ghosts. There's people who believe in angels and demons, and then, of course, maybe one person's ghost is another person's alien, and there's another's Bigfoot, and who knows what else. And who's to say who's right and wrong? It's very, very big. And so I just wanted to kind of create one place where we could have this discussion, where the skeptics could weigh in, where the scientists could weigh in, where believers and everyone else could just say, I don't know what happened, but this is exactly what I saw, filmed, recorded, or whatever. And it's kind of central to everything that I still do today.
And it's growing, Jeff, isn't it? It seems to be getting bigger and bigger. You know, I can tell just as a barometer with this program and the audience and how it grows. But you've got to be seeing that, too.
Oh, of course, yeah. And I mean, first of all, and as you well know, and I'm sure your audience knows, the subject has gone so mainstream. You can't turn on your television, your radio, internet, without just being inundated with paranormal content everywhere. And I think there's something to that. If we're talking strictly about ghosts, I think we're in a pattern that really started back in the 1860s. The spiritualist movement, of course, started in 1848. And then I'm not so sure it would have made it if not for the U.S. Civil War, if not for tens of thousands of people dying, in this bloodbath on our own soil and people needing answers and maybe not getting them from their religious institutions. And then so everyone's turning to mediums. Help me. I need to reach out. They're having these experiences. And then maybe it wanes a little bit, but then World War I, World War II, everybody's, you know, talking about it again, seeking mediums, again in Vietnam, and then, of course, September 11th. You've got a world in turmoil. You've
Absolutely.
Got people who are nervous and still need those answers. And here we are again.
You know, I've got to tell you, Jeff, the work you've done, I've been reading the revised edition of Encyclopedia of Haunted Places, and we'll get into that in just a second.
Sure.
After we come back from this break. But, I mean, how did these stories all come to you?
You know what's great? In the beginning, it was a lot of work. I don't mean to say I'm lazy or anything now, but I've become a magnet through the website, through my work. You know, people start, and I'm sure you're the same way, George. You know, people now come to you when they've got something odd to talk about because they know you've heard a lot of this stuff. They want the insight, but I think more than anything, they simply want someone to listen. I see that at conferences. I see that in my own emails, you know, hundreds of emails. I just want to get this off my chest. I want to share what happened with someone who won't think I'm insane. And so I know. And that's not always true, by the way. Sometimes I do.
Up next, the Encyclopedia of Haunted Places with Jeff Belanger on Coast to Coast AM. Well, great news for Streamlink members. Now you can go back 3 years into the archives for past programs. How about that? Not a member of Streamlink yet? For just pennies a day, all you have to do is go to coasttocoastam.com and sign up for Streamlink. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're with the expert here on the paranormal investigations, Jeff Belanger. Jeff, when we talked in the Encyclopedia of Haunted Places came out, it's now been updated. Tell me a little bit about the stories, who contributed to the book, and let's go from there.
Yeah, well, the book was actually born a few years ago. My publisher had contacted me and said, hey, what do you think about writing a big international directory? And I said, oh, man, no way. You know, I mean, that sounds like an insane amount of work. But then I thought about it. I said, the reason it's so much work is to do it right, you have to get local. You have to have been there. You have to talk to the people. You have to really know these places. And so the idea was, well, let's reach out to these paranormal investigators. There's so many thousands of them now all over the world. These are the folks that know these places. Let's reach out to them and you know, get their contributions. And so that's how the book was born. And I'm proud to say that it's still going in that direction. We've got people from all over the world who are writing about the places they've investigated. I think we're up to 120 different contributors, just different authors that worked on this book, writing about the places that they looked into, the photos, the stories. And you know, some of the criteria was we were looking for places that were open to the public, so we didn't want any private residences. We don't want to create problems for anyone. Places that have some kind of history, often a tragic one, but not always, and a place that has ongoing phenomena, so something that's not just one witness one time, but just something where it's being perpetuated, still talked about today. And we're drawn to these locations. There's a reason we hear about them. And so that was kind of the thought. And so now we're expanding. We're adding more international locations, kind of a travel guide. But as I warn people right in the introduction, this book is not finished. It never will be, thank goodness. And I hope to do many more.
We'll talk about some of these various locations, Jeff. Why is it that these haunted locations, by and large, though, have had tragedy surrounding them? It seems like people love the tragedies.
Yeah, I think the reason is that part of it is it's almost like history demanding to be remembered. You know, you go to a place like Gettysburg where we know the horrible tragedy that took place there, and I think it's history being remembered. It's the living breathing that in, you know, tuning into that effect, remembering, and maybe that heightens our senses a little bit, and that heightening of the senses allows us to have these supernatural experiences, allows us to see a little further than we might see, say, in a strip mall, allows us to hear things that we wouldn't hear in our own living rooms, and that's what people are picking up on, because we're sensitive, because we're walking in a place of tragedy, a place of the dead, hallowed ground, cemeteries, battlefields, you know, places where people were murdered. I think that all plays into the living more than the dead.
I get calls from friends who say, tell us a haunted place. Where can we go? Where can we get scared? Who can scare us? They like that.
Yeah, we do, don't we? I know. Isn't that funny? I have a 2.5-year-old daughter who I'm now just trying to explain what I do for a living, and it's getting complicated.
Yeah, says, how do you do that, Jim?
Why you like to be scared, Daddy? I said, well, we'll get there. You know, we'll keep explaining it. But you're right. We do love to be scared. I think we like to have our senses heightened. It's a thrill. It's an adrenaline rush. But the ghost experience allows us to talk about mortality, these big subjects that are so scary. I don't want to talk about me or you dying, but if we talk about the ghost that's been seen at the library in town, that allows us to have that discussion without being so specific.
Jeff, have you found that almost every community has at least one spooky story, at least one location where people believe it to be haunted?
I have yet to find a place that's immune from this phenomenon. I mean, you go somewhere and you get local and you start talking to people. There's the cemetery, the old building. There's some legend, even if just the kids know about it. Or maybe the kids even manufactured it. We don't know. I mean, that's all part of this. It's not, it's sometimes legend and folklore that combines with history to make these things, that old abandoned road in the woods, these kinds of things. But no, I haven't found a community yet that doesn't have something. And the more you dig in, the more, you know, visible I become, and the more my website grows, the more I hear about these things. And you say, wow, these are great legends. You find similarities. You find, you know, the abandoned road in Massachusetts has got a similar story to the abandoned road in Texas. You know, the old train tracks, you know, where the car gets pushed across the train tracks to safety by some unseen little hands because allegedly a school bus was hit by a train there. I mean, these legends pop up. In very similar stories all over the world.
Are they true in that, you know, how can you have a same story in four different cities, for example?
Sure, they're true. They're true in that they're perceived as real, and perception is reality, isn't it? You know, and that's part of this. A legend is a real, living, breathing thing. It grows, it eats, it sleeps, and it can die. And this is why I think there's why we have to pay attention to them. If you take a haunted building and people find out that it's got this ghostly reputation, there's a reason. If no one talks about those ghosts, if no one has any sightings for many, many years, people will slowly stop talking about it and eventually will just forget. The legend will die. There has to be ongoing phenomena that reinforces that legend, that keeps us talking, that keeps us saying, yeah, the Queen Mary, it sure is haunted, that keeps us saying, you know, Waverly Hills and in Kentucky, you know, these places that we hear about again and again, those sightings reinforce the story.
Why do people always believe that older places are haunted places?
I think deep down we all have an appreciation of history. We all have a sense of where we came from. And again, ghosts are sometimes just history demanding to be remembered. The longer it's been around, the more chance for tragedy, the more chance that it's seen interesting times. It's not a rule, of course. I mean, goodness, I've heard about condo developments that are 6 months old and seem to be haunted. And then, of course, we look back at, well, what took place on the land on this location? Was it a battlefield? Was there anything else going on? And even then, sometimes you can't find anything. Yet, the phenomena seems real. People are reporting strange things that aren't necessarily just in creepy old houses that are falling apart. But there is something about that setting. Again, are we thinking about, boy, this place is a century old, 2 centuries old, and tuning into something that we wouldn't tune into if we were in a different environment?
We were talking earlier about how the public and the perception of ghostly phenomenon seems to be increasing. What's doing that, Jeff?
Well, as we were saying, how, you know, we've got a world in turmoil, and we've got a culture that's less influenced by large religious institutions than ever before. I mean, church attendance is down in the major religions. Not all churches, of course. Some are growing. Synagogues, mosques, all religions. But I still think spirituality is a basic human need. People need that. And I realized this years ago when I was on, you know, a ghost hunt, and I was with people running around a cemetery in the middle of the night, and I said, oh, my goodness, these people are in church. I get it. Some people, the lucky, can go to church or mosque or synagogue and get that spirituality in an organized system because there's a lot of support there. But some of us have to go out and try to wrap our hands around these ghosts in haunted places with EMF meters and cameras and digital recorders. And for us, that's touching the other side. That's letting us know there's more to life than just, you know, paying taxes and dying one day. And I really believe that plays such a huge role in all of this.
How do you get these stories into this revision, for example? Did they just contact you unsolicited, or did you send people out? How did that all happen?
Well, now that there's such a network of people that I'm in touch with, it's just basically putting the word out. You know, we're going to be working on another one of these. And I feel safe, even though this book's only about 2 weeks old right now, I feel safe saying there will be yet another one a few years down the road. And so right along, we've got people always saying, hey, in some cases, it's easy. They said, I can't believe you left out such and such a place. Well, like I said, this will never be this would fill 1,000 bookshelves if it listed every haunt in the world. And even then, it wouldn't be done. So in some cases, I got the opportunity to right a few wrongs where we left out something like Waverly Hills wasn't in the first edition. My goodness, I'm sorry. Well, fix this time. You know? It's like leaving Let It Be off your Beatles greatest hit or something, you know. I mean, but we fixed it, and then other places where we want to make sure we get the off the beaten path kind of locations, you know, little sites around the world that you may not have heard of, but are well known in those regions. And so that's the objective: keep it diverse and show that this is a global phenomenon that affects all kinds of locations and places and people.
We'll get into all these locations at the top of the hour, Jeff, because there are many. We probably won't fit them all in tonight.
Well, I would hope not. It's a long book.
It is. We'll be here for 16 Halloweens.
Right.
The people who go out hunting for ghosts, those mm-hmm. who really want to make a go of it, what do you recommend people do in terms of the equipment and the seriousness of this research?
Well, here's the thing. I'll probably be one of the few people that say, I think we need to be a little less serious.
Really? Okay. All right. Go ahead. Explain.
And that's kind of a lighter approach is something that I've been thinking about lately, because number one, I'm starting to see a shift very recently back to the old ways, the ways of maybe 50, 60 years ago, when people like Brad Steiger and Hans Holzer and, you know, these are people that looked at all aspects of the paranormal. They didn't just go in with ghost glasses on or UFO glasses or Bigfoot. They looked at everything. And in the last maybe 8-9 years, everybody got so specific. It was you're either a ghost group, my goodness, or a demon group, or you're with MUFON, and never between shall any meet. And now we're starting to see, you know, I was talking to a MUFON researcher this past week, and I said, my goodness, we started to notice that so many people who had UFO sightings also had ghost sightings. And he said, I realized that I'm just not qualified to look into that, and I need to get smarter there, and I need to start working with people that also know that aspect of it. And so I think what we're seeing is just a turn back to looking at all of this as paranormal, you know, legends, that we have to look at the stories and not go in with any preconceptions. Just go in and ask the questions and see what we get. And so my thought is that we need to start taking a lighter approach. Just start with the stories. You don't need thermal imaging cameras. You don't need, you know, EMF meters for that. If you want to get serious and get specific, you can do that later. But for the most part, let's just start with collecting this data. And it can be a lot of fun. I think that's why so many of us do this. It's just so intriguing.
And that's the important thing, too. Have some fun doing this.
Yeah, my goodness. I don't want to work for a living. Are you kidding? I want to have fun. I want to enjoy what I do. I mean, if you enjoy what you do, then you'll never work a day in your life, as they say. And I'm blessed to be able to do this. I'm so fortunate and thankful for people who are reading my books and going to the lectures that I get to do this, that I get to gather these stories and talk to so many different people that have had amazing experiences that, like, it's changed my life, not just theirs, in hearing all these stories. And that's and I just hope other people can find some joy in that as well. And they're taking supernatural vacations, and they're going to conferences and ghost tours and everything else, because they want to touch that. They want to just get in touch with those stories.
Have you ever spent the night in a cemetery?
Of course. Are you kidding? That's where my bedroom is.
Yeah. All right. Any bizarre experiences doing that?
No, I really haven't. I'm one of those people that if I were a ghost, I think a cemetery would be about the last place that I would haunt. You know, I mean, front row at great concerts and you know, 50 yard lines at sporting events. That's the kind of places I would haunt. But I think something about the cemetery is that you're in the place of the dead, and when living people are walking there, I mean, you're walking above bones and bodies. You know, that's where you're going one day. That's we're all going to get there at some point, and it heightens your senses, and heightening the senses, you extend them, and in extending them, you're opening up. I believe. I don't believe in a sixth sense, but I do believe in an extension of the existing five, whereas some people can see more, hear more, feel more, etc. And I think we all have that ability. And in a cemetery, for regular folks who don't think about this stuff a lot, it's a natural place to extend that and start thinking about these things. And maybe you will have a ghost experience in that lone cemetery on a moonlit night and watching the, you know, the moon dance off the headstones and things like that. It is a great setting.
I'm not so sure we should be afraid of the dead anyway, Jeff. I think we should have more concern about some of the living.
Oh my goodness! Of course, and you know, someone asked me recently what's a frightening experience I had on a ghost investigation, and I said, well, you know, watching people with little K2 EMF meters, which registers electromagnetic fields, standing in the cupola of this old hotel, getting all kinds of flashing lights on their equipment and believing for certain that they were talking to a ghost. And then an employee pulled me aside and said, "You see that flagpole right above you? That's a cell phone tower." And so what they were picking up was cell phone signals from all around the region dancing through the tower right above their heads. But they couldn't be convinced of that. They were sure it was a ghost and not that giant tower right above their heads. And I said, "That's a little frightening. You know, we do fool ourselves sometimes." And the living, of course, my goodness, some of the stupid things people do, the trespassing and the breaking and entering, this isn't helpful. You know, this isn't good stuff. That's the stuff that frightens me. Not so much the dead.
You are a Satanologist. What's the difference between that and a demonologist?
That's a joke I started making about a year ago. I said, you know, everybody seemed to be a demonologist. I said, well, I'm going to be a Satanologist. You know, and if you've got a demon, you can call Zaphis or the Warrens or some of these other folks. But when you've got Satan, then call me. I'm not getting out of bed for anything less than Satan. So it started as just a big joke that I think everybody got a little too heavy with all the demon stuff. It became so in vogue with all the TV shows and things like that. So my tongue in my cheek, I'm now proudly a Satanologist. I've yet to get a single case, but I'm still waiting for the phone to ring.
And what do you think that phone call could be?
Oh,
man. If it's legitimate, what will it be?
Oh, God, are you kidding? I don't know. I mean, you know, here's the thing. It all comes down to the perception of the witness. You know, and I'm seeing the shift already. You know, a few years ago, ghosts were enough for television. You know, ghosts were scary enough. And now it's got to be demons. We got to be hunting demons, not just ghosts. It's got to be dark and scary and frightening and evil. And people watch this. And maybe 5 years ago, they would hear strange knocks in their attic and say, man, maybe we have a ghost. Well, now some of those same people, same phenomena are saying, we may have a demon in here. And that's a lot more frightening for someone who might be under mental duress. They could say, well, a ghost was a person. I can deal with that. But a demon who just wants to kill you, eat you, do evil things and can't be stopped? I mean, how does someone deal with that? And that's a concern I have. So, again, trying to poke fun at all of us, I tried to just be the Satanologist. Not that I'm saying there's no such thing. I've just yet to encounter one. I have encountered some pretty awful people in my life, and I imagine if they pass on and hang around, you know,
yeah,
maybe that could be the kind of awful thing that's plaguing some folks, and you might even label that demonic. But, you know, it's a little scary when people go in and start imposing their beliefs on people who might be under duress. And one way to do that is to say, I'm a demonologist, and you have demons here. When, you know, are you certain, and how can you be certain?
Jeff, what has Hollywood done to this whole field?
Yeah, like I said, especially recently, it's getting darker out there. Now, on the one hand, there's a good part of it too. I mean, this subject isn't so weird anymore. You know, I mean, goodness, 10, 15 years ago, we might be locked up by now. They probably would have pulled us off the air, you know, but now, thanks to so many pioneers, Art Bell, of course, and all these other folks that have been talking about it, and now that it's on every television station, it's kind of okay to talk about this, and that's a really good thing. It's out in the open. It's out of the closet. We can sit around the office water coolers and say, yeah, you know, when I grew up, I had some weird ghostly experiences, and I think I might be having something right now. So that's good. But the bad thing is that, you know, everybody's trying to get in on the act. We've got a few amateurs that are making a mess of things, just a few, not too many.
Right.
And again, when things have to be darker to trump whatever else is out there, that's a problem, because we're starting to tap into some really primal stuff that you know, really preys on people's fears. And we're not so certain it's real, but, you know, you show it to someone enough and it'll be perceived as real. And that's a dangerous thing.
With all these years then of investigations, what have you concluded? What have you decided about this entire field?
All right, you ready? I'm going to give it all away right here.
Here we go.
Something happens after we die.
That's all you need to know, Jeff. You know what?
You know, honestly, I mean, it sounds like a joke. It's not. That's when I started in this, gosh, right, pretty much in college, I was pretty close to being an atheist. Not quite there, but close. And it seemed to me ghosts were like the least common denominator of spirituality. I broke it down to that point. And I've come to the conclusion, and I can't prove this to anyone, but I believe it in my heart, something happens after we die. There's more to it. That's how far I've gotten. And I hope to learn more, and maybe in another 20, 30 years, I'll be able to expand on that. But that's where I'm at right now.
I wonder if it's almost like being in a dream state, but perpetually.
Maybe. I would hate to think that, you know, I'm so excited about what I do because I learn something new all the time. I always feel like I'm growing as a person, as a sentient being, and I would hate for that to ever end. I would hate to think that I would ever stop learning and growing and finding new stuff. That, to me, would probably be hell, you know? That would be the worst possible outcome. So I guess in my guts tell me that does go on.
Jeff, when we come back, we will get into the Encyclopedia of Haunted Places. We're going to start going around to some of these ghostly locales. We'll also talk about legend tripping next on Coast to Coast AM.